Thank you again for kindly coming to take part in today's program. Again, we remind you that this is the time to put your cell phone in silent mode, and it's also the opportunity for little children to go downstairs and get the blessings of Lakshmi Narayan. Lakshmi and Narayan are very kind to children. I'm not. Okay. Om Agyanatimi Dantasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Tathati Shapadantikam. You're looking for someone. Who are you looking for? Oh, I guess looking for Krishna. You guys aren't serious. You're not going to sit here and listen to a lecture for 3/4 of an hour. I know you're not. Who's with these children who just came in? Yeah, guys can go have fun outside. It's going to be really boring in here. So we're continuing our review of the dashavatars of Lord Krishna, the descents of the Lord into this material world. And today the topic is the Buddhavatar. Lord Buddha is described in Srimad Bhagavatam in two places, in first canto and second canto. Tata kalo samprabhate sammohaya suradvisham Buddha namna anjana shuta kikateshu bhavishyati. In the first canto, it's described that in the beginning of Kali Yuga, Lord Buddha appears, sammohaya suradvisham, to bewilder the atheists. Srila Prabhupada explains that Lord Buddha comes. Srila Jayadev Goswami also describes, out of compassion for the animals and for the people who are like animals, who are needlessly killing animals under the plea of Vedic sacrifice. Because in the Vedic literature, animal sacrifices are allowed under certain very particular conditions. The degraded people took it as an opportunity for killing animals wholesale and eating them for sense gratification. So rather than argue that this was contrary to the Vedic principles, Lord Buddha simply rejected the Vedas completely and taught his own doctrine, in which an essential component is ahimsa, or nonviolence. So in this way he rescued the animals and animal killers, and at the same time he gave them the opportunity to become devoted to him. And so we see throughout Asia so many temples of Lord Buddha, and people are offering devotional, making devotional offerings to Lord Buddha. Although they don't believe in God, but Krishna tricks them by coming in the form of essentially an atheist and teaching a non-Vedic philosophy. The second place where Lord Buddha is mentioned is in the second canto. Devadrisham nigamabhartmani nishtitanam purbir mayena vihitabir adrishya turbhi lokan gnatam mativimoham atipralobham vesham vidhaya bahupashita opadharmyam. When the atheists, after being well-versed in the Vedic scientific knowledge, annihilate inhabitants of different planets by flying unseen in the sky on well-built rockets prepared by the great scientist Maya, the Lord will bewilder their minds by dressing himself attractively as Buddha and will preach on sub-religious principles. Purport. This incarnation of Lord Buddha is not the same Buddha incarnation we have in the present history of mankind. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the Buddha incarnation mentioned in this verse appeared in a different Kali age. In the duration of life of one Manu, there are more than 72 Kali Yugas. And in one of them, the particular type of Buddha mentioned here would appear. Lord Buddha incarnates at a time when the people are most materialistic and preaches common sense religious principles. Such ahimsa is not a religious principle itself, but it is an important quality for persons who are actually religious. It is a common sense religion because one is advised to do no harm to any other animal or living being, because such harmful actions are equally harmful to he who does the harm. But before learning these principles of nonviolence, one has to learn two other principles, namely to be humble and to be prideless. Unless one is humble and prideless, one cannot be harmless and nonviolent. And after being nonviolent, one has to learn tolerance and simplicity of living. One must offer respects to the great religious preachers and spiritual leaders, and also train the senses for controlled action. Learning to be unattached to family and home, and enacting devotional service to the Lord, etc. At the ultimate stage, one has to accept the Lord and become his devotee. Otherwise, there is no religion. In religious principles, there must be God in the center. Otherwise, simple moral instructions are merely sub-religious principles, generally known as upadharma, or nearness to religious principles. So, another Buddha, because there are different ages, as we have 12 calendar months, so in the day of, or not even 12 calendar months, we have so many hours 24 hours in a day, 12 for half, 12 for the other half, a.m. and p.m. So there are periods of time called the manvantaras, the time periods of Manu. And in these manvantaras, there are so many ages, more than 72, because there's, 14 Manus in a day of Brahma. So 72 Kali Yugas in the life of one Manu. So, and in each of these Yugas, there's an incarnation of the Lord. So sometimes we hear about, for example, the Varaha avatar. But then it's explained that there are two Varaha avatars described in Srimad Bhagavatam. One lifts the earth from the lower parts of the universe, and the other kills Hiranyaksha. One is white, one is red. So how is this reconciled? They appeared in different ages. And then the story is sort of merged together. So we get one story, but really two different incarnations. So here also there are different Buddhas. And they share certain features. Devadrisha, what is that? Devadrisham nigama bartmini nishtitana. They're dealing with Devadrisham. In the first canto, Suradrisham. So Suradrisham, Devadrisham, same thing. Demons. Or those who are envious of the godly people. These are the people for whom Lord Buddha appears, or with whom he's especially concerned. Devadrisham, nigama vartmani nishtitana. And what's going on in the period of this second Buddha incarnation? The scientists have run amok. They've picked up some knowledge from the Vedas, nigama, vartmani, from the Vedic path, nishtitanam, they're very well situated, but what have they picked up? They haven't picked up the actual religious principles. They've picked up some knowledge by which they want to exploit material nature. Real knowledge is described in the Bhagavad Gita. Amanitvam adambitvam ahimsak shantirajavam. What is that? Acharyo pasamam socham stharyam atmavinigraha. Right? Amanitvam adambitvam ahimsak shantirajavam. Yes. Acharyo pasamam socham stharyam atmavinigraha. Indriyarteshu vairagyam anahankaram eva cha. Janma mrityu jara vyadi dukkha doshana darshana. The beginning of knowledge is pridelessness, humility. A person who thinks he knows everything is never going to advance in spiritual knowledge because he's so puffed up, so proud. What can you tell him? What can he learn? He's arrogant. And therefore, adambitva, freedom from arrogance, is an essential component for developing knowledge. Amanitvam, adambitvam, ahimsa, non-violence, kshanti, tolerance, arjavam, straightforwardness, acharyopashanam, to approach a bona fide spiritual master, shocham, cleanliness, stharyam, steadiness, atmavinigraha, control of the senses, indriyarteshu vairagyam, renunciation of objects for sense enjoyment, anahankarameva, freedom from false ego, janma mrityu jara vyadi dukkha dosha anudarshana, to be always aware of the miseries of birth, death, old age, and disease that are inherent features of this world. Ananyenaiva yogena bhaktirabhyabhicharini. And in this list of items of knowledge, the essential item is pure devotional service to Krishna. Without that item, all the rest are essentially useless, just to be non-violent or to be humble and not to be connected with the personality of Godhead is ultimately a waste of time. And it won't last. Without a connection with the supreme personality of Godhead, whatever good qualities we have will be on a tottering platform. But when one is actually God-conscious, Krishna-conscious, all the good qualities of the demigods automatically develop within him. So here, the demons have come up strongly, Devadvisham, Nigamavartmani Nishtatanam, and they're solidly situated in knowledge pulled out of the Vedas that they want to use for exploitation. Purbir mayena vihitabir adrishyaturbhi. And the specific technology that they have is that they have these flying fortresses that move at such a speed or in such a way that no one can see them. Now they call it stealth technology. But it was already there, mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam thousands of years ago. So the Adrishya Turgi, Lokang Natam, and what do they do with these flying machines? They use them as opportunistic vantage points from which to murder people. Yes. Lokang Natam. How to murder people. This is the demonic mentality. In the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna vividly describes this mentality of the ruthless materialists whose only interest is to squeeze out whatever they can from nature, to squeeze out whatever they can from other human beings, to squeeze out whatever they can from the lives of the animals. Everything is for my exploitation. If I manipulate things, if I get it right, I can have power, I can have wealth, I can have enjoyment, I can control, I can enjoy. This is the demonic, materialistic mentality. So when that mentality is running amok, at one point, Lord Buddha comes. Mativi moham, ati pralobham besham vitaya, bahubhashyate opadharmyam. He comes, mativi moham, to bewilder their minds. And how does he do it? He's very attractively dressed, just as Lord Buddha in the present history is very attractively dressed. And
Bahubhashyate. He'll talk a lot. He'll talk a lot. And what will be the subject matter? Opadharmya. Opadharmya means not quite dharma, but opadharmya. Something that's what Srila Prabhupada calls sub-religious principles. Opadharmya. Non-violence, humility, peace of mind. These things. Without God consciousness. Well, this is for the less intelligent people. For the intelligent or fortunate, the direct path of devotional service is the only path recommended. But for the demons, here's mercy given even to them. We know you're not going to be God conscious. We know sarva dharman pratyaja mamekam sharanam braja is out of the question. You're not going to surrender to Krishna. So what can we tell you? The recommendation is, all right, we'll give you some sub-religious principles. Especially ahimsa, non-violence. And we'll give you some tricky philosophy that will keep you occupied. And at the same time, we'll give you an opportunity to revere Lord Buddha so that the trick becomes complete, that although you're an atheist, you become a devotee of Buddha, who's the incarnation of Krishna. So this is the strategy. Bahubhashyate, a lot of sophisticated or bewildering talk. That's the method. The coming back to the earlier Lord Buddha, the one mentioned in first canto, I have some discussion of his doctrine in my book, Vanity Karma. So I thought I'd read you a little bit about that. Okay, who's the competition here? First of all, maybe a little history. Siddhartha Gautama, as Buddha was first known, was a prince who lived a life of royal privilege and indulgence within the palace grounds, where his parents sheltered him from the harsh realities of the outside world, a world to which they never allowed him to stray. But one day he ventured out and encountered for the first time a man who was diseased, and a man who was old, and the corpse of a man, and a wandering ascetic. Inquiring from his servants, he came to know of the miseries of disease and old age and death, and came to know that these were the common fate of everyone, and that he himself, therefore, would inevitably suffer disease and finally grow old and die. Profoundly understanding that these miseries rendered meaningless his life of royal enjoyment, he soon abandoned the palace to wander as an ascetic himself, in search of ultimate enlightenment. After years of fasting and self-denial seemed to have brought him nowhere, he sat beneath a tree, determined not to rise again until he had attained perfection. And it was there that in his meditation he at last became the Buddha, the enlightened one. From Bodh Gaya, the place of his enlightenment, in what is now the state of Bihar, he traveled west to Sarnath, near Varanasi, and there in a place called the Deer Park, gave his first sermon, in which he set forth what came to be called the Four Noble Truths. The first of these was the truth of suffering. Life is full of miseries. The miseries inevitably imposed upon us by birth, disease, old age, and death. The miseries of pain, grief, sorrow, despair, and lamentation. The miseries of having thrust upon us what we wish to avoid, and having wrenched away from us what we wish to keep. The miseries we must endure when what we strive for eludes our grasp. That's the truth of suffering. The second was the truth of the cause. Suffering is caused by desire and by ignorance, which ultimately depend on one another in a sort of interdependent origination. Ignorance, he said, comes from false impressions. These, in turn, I won't go into how, give rise to consciousness, which causes the mind and body. The mind-body causes the sense organs, which cause contact with the objects of the senses. This contact gives rise to experience, which leads to desire, and then to clinging. Clinging leads to the will to be born, which then causes rebirth. Rebirth leads to suffering, which in turn causes ignorance, and so we're back to where we started. This is called Bahupashyate, a lot of talk. The truth of the cause. This is his doctrine about where everything comes from. We'll talk about that a little more later. Third was the truth of cessation. Our suffering will cease when we are free from desire and ignorance. And fourth was the truth of the way. To reach this freedom from suffering, one should follow an eightfold path consisting of right vision, right resolve, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Upadharma. Such are the Four Noble Truths and the righteous eightfold path said to have been taught by the Buddha. The Buddha shares in the Vedic worldview, which sees a connection between desire and suffering. Our desires send us running after enjoyment. Whatever enjoyment we find, we become attached to, and our attachments pull us forward into another round of birth and death. The Bhagavad Gita says, Purusha prakriti stho hi bhunkte prakriti jan gunan karanam gunasangasya sadasad yoni janmashu. When a living being in the world of matter tries to enjoy the qualities of matter, this becomes the cause of clinging to those qualities birth after birth. And that becomes a source of suffering. Now, I'm not going to read everything. Let me abbreviate here. according to Bhagavad Gita, okay, we hear, therefore, both from the teachings of the Buddha and from the Bhagavad Gita, that to become free from miseries, we must become free from desires and ignorance. But now the Buddha and the Bhagavad Gita part company. The Buddha pointing toward purification of self, Buddha toward repudiation of self. According to the Gita, I am covered by ignorance, afflicted by material desires, but by self-purification I can attain spiritual knowledge and transform my desires from material to spiritual. That's called Krishna consciousness. According to the Buddha, however, the very sense of I is illusory. There is no I, no self. From moment to moment, what I suppose to be myself is but an ever-changing assemblage of physical and mental forces, the body, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. I'm just sort of an amalgamation of all these things, but there's no actual self. That's the Buddhist doctrine. Very similar to the modern scientific outlook, in which I'm an amalgamation of chemicals and electronic processes, but there's no actual self. The self is just a kind of an illusion. There's a real alliance between the Buddhists and the scientists, which makes it interesting that Lord Buddha later appears to allure the IIT grads who've been pulled into rocket science. So in Buddha's view, the attainment of nirvana, literally blowing out or extinguishing, involves cessation not only of desire and ignorance, but of one's own supposed existence, of one's very own sense of self, one's own individual being. When I no longer exist, neither does my ignorance, nor my false impressions, my consciousness, my mind and body, my senses, and the objects with which they come in touch, nor my experience, nor desires and clinging, nor the will to be born, nor rebirth. So you've stopped the whole problem. When I no longer exist, I no longer have suffering. Case solved. This is what Srila Prabhupada called spiritual suicide. That when I want to get free from suffering, then I kill myself, spiritually speaking. The self, the ego, is such a source of desires and suffering. So if I extinguish the self, the problem's gone. Prabhupada gave the example. Some child had a fever. The doctor was called in and injected the child with poison. Mother said, "My child's not breathing. Is the fever still there?" "No." "Good." And this is the Buddhist solution. We got rid of the whole problem by getting rid of the child. A self that doesn't exist can feel no pain. So apart from the unattractiveness of this solution, that we solve our problem by extinguishing our identity, there's philosophical problems with these doctrines, and I go into that too. On origins, what does Buddha tell us? Nothing exists independently. The existence of everything depends on the existence of everything else. Fine. But why should this be so? If that's some sort of law, some sort of universal principle. Where does the law come from? Concerning rebirth, again, perplexity. Since there's no soul, no individual I never transmigrate from one birth to the next. Rather, at death, this assemblage of physical and mental forces bubbles up into a new such assemblage. But then why should the new I have to suffer for what the old I did? That doesn't make a lot of sense. And again, if there's some law, some universal principle that makes this happen, and how else could it happen, where does the law or principle come from? Why even should the noble path of right vision, right resolve, right speech, and other rights lead us to freedom from suffering unless there's some universal law, some universal principle that makes it so? Without such a universal path, universal law, the right path might lead us to nirvana on Tuesday and away from it on Thursday, or nirvana at 9 a.m. and near miss at noontime. And again, if there's some law that makes the noble path reliably lead to nirvana, must some ultimate cause not lie in the background to make it so? That's, in summary, our submission on Lord Buddha's doctrine. You're trying to avoid the cause of all causes. You're trying to avoid the personality of Godhead. You're going this way, everything depends on everything else, because there's this principle called universal interdependent origination. But where's this principle come from? There's the Eightfold Path that leads to nirvana. Why does it lead to nirvana? What law makes it so? You have all these laws, but you don't have a source for the laws. Now that doesn't really work. It doesn't work at all. And Lord Buddha rejects the Vedas. Later he's challenged by whom? By Shankara. And what does Shankara say? He said, no, everything is not, there is a self. But what is that self? That self is the ultimate truth, and you're one with that ultimate truth, and it has no form, no qualities, no activities, no nothing. What does that mean? It means essentially you don't really exist. You do, but your existence has no features. You don't do anything, you don't feel anything, you don't experience anything, you don't know anything. There's no difference between you and anything else. So one philosophy is Shunyavad, Lord Buddha's philosophy, everything is zero. And the other is Nirvisheshvad, everything is one. But what is that one? It has no form, no qualities, no name, no activities. It's zero. So although Lord Buddha's teaching oneness, teaching zero, and Shankara's teaching oneness, their doctrine is essentially the same, which is why Shankara is sometimes called a crypto-Buddhist, a Buddhist in disguise. It's really Buddhism coming in through the back door. Buddha rejects the Vedas, and Shankara says, no, no, I accept the Vedas. What are the Vedas teaching? Well, you don't really exist. You exist, but there's no difference between your existence and the existence of everything else. So these are the, and that's called Bahubhashyate. Talk, 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 talk. And impractical. If I don't really exist, what will I do? If everything's zero, then where does that leave me? What am I just going to do? Sit here? Everything's zero, everything's zero. Or if everything's one, everything's one. Therefore, there's a lot of talk about Buddhism and a lot of talk about oneness. But after all the talk, they break out a cigarette or they have a cup of coffee or they go looking for a girl. Because you can't sustain that. It's not practical. It's not something you can act on. It's all word jugglers. Oh, this is what Srila Prabhupada came to challenge. Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschacchadeshatani. There is a cause of all causes, the personality of Godhead. Every living being exists as a servant of Krishna, and our business is to give up all other engagements and engage in the service of Krishna. It doesn't mean I don't do anything, I don't act, I don't work, I don't perform my duties, but everything is done for Krishna's service. I'm going to stop here and see what kind of questions you might have. If any. Yes?
In the history of Buddhism, Brahmanism was a first part. It challenged Brahmanism a lot, Buddhism.
I think we need more volume.
Hello?
Yes, that's better.
Yes, Brahmanism challenged Buddhism from its start. And yes. Buddhism rejected Vedic religion, caste system, everything. And in Brahmanism, the four castes, that is Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, were there already. And Buddha rejected everything. And most of the lower castes, that is the Vaishya, Shudra, Kshatriyas, they were attracted to Buddhism a lot at that time. And Brahmins were more to Vedic religion, like Shankaracharya, Madhvacharya, even afterwards. Why they were attracted to Buddhism more, and why did Brahmins
Buddhism more?
The lower castes, like the Shudras and all these,
it's attractive, you know, everyone can play. The caste Brahmins say, we're the only ones who can play. We can attain perfection. We have all the knowledge. We have all the privilege. We have, you know, you can't get anywhere without us. And if I come and I'm egalitarian, then everyone can play. Then the people who were shut out become interested. Leaving aside Lord Buddha, let's take more recent times. Prabhupada put this in context of the spread of Islam in India, where the Brahmins were saying again, you know, unless you're up with us, unless you're born as Brahmins, you know, you're really not up there. Well, you can still be a Kshatriya, or you can be a Vaishya. If you're lower than that, you know, you're just for us to step on. And Islam comes along and says, hey, everyone can play. Doesn't matter what your birth is, it doesn't matter what your background is. Everyone can participate. And so the people who were previously kept down, now they can become first-class citizens. As long as the Brahmins were keeping a stranglehold on everything, only their group could really have power or privilege or access to higher truth even. But now if I become a Muslim, I become a first-class citizen. If I remain a Hindu, I'm on the bottom of the heap. If I become a Muslim, suddenly I'm on the same level as everybody else. Now what should I do? And so Islam spreads from this sort of decadent Brahmanism in which caste is determined not by qualification, but by birth. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu challenges this Brahminical hegemony more effectively, that everyone can take up the Vedic path and attain perfection by chanting the holy name of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. pretending that caste doesn't exist is foolish. There are always, by God's arrangement, different classes of people. In the Soviet Union, in their classless society, someone was teaching in the university, someone was sweeping the street, and it wasn't the same person. Someone was in politics, someone was in the army, someone was in the university. Because different people have different capabilities and different tendencies. These four sections are everywhere, whether they're acknowledged or not. But in the Bhagavad Gita, yata pravittir bhutanam yena sarvamidam tatam svakarmana tam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manav. Every human being can attain perfection simply by performing his prescribed duty in Krishna consciousness. So this is the Lord Chaitanya's resolution or Krishna's resolution. Mami partavya pashvitya yepisu papionya striya shutra tata vaishat tepi yanti parangatim. Everyone can come to Krishna. No restrictions. Is that okay? Something else? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, the pace at which Buddhism spread and the pace at which Buddhism spread and the amount of number of people who became Buddhists is very large, you know. Not to compare, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came with such an attractive movement like Sankirtan and so much of philosophy along with it. What was Lord Buddha's attraction that it, you know, is just...
What was Lord Buddha's...
Attraction. That
attraction. He's the Vibhuti incarnation of Krishna. Krishna is all attractive. Even when he appears as Buddha, he's attractive. If Krishna appears as an atheist, he'll be an all attractive atheist. Yes. Oh, he attracts people. Yes. Forget these Vedas. Follow me. And then they become indirectly Krishna conscious.
Hare Krishna. Is Buddha wrong in saying have no desires, or like you do not
exist?
How
will you have no desire?
Let me complete this.
All right, that's fair enough.
Yeah. So he says that you should not have desires or you do not exist, as you said, as compared to doing everything in the service of God. These two are very different way of thinking. I don't know how they come together.
Two very different ways of thinking. One is to become free from all desires, and the other is to engage in the service of God. Right? So, what's your question from that?
Is Buddha wrong in saying this? Or
is Buddha wrong in saying this? Yes and no. To become free from all desires is good. But how do you get free from all desires? He says desires lead to suffering. Well, that's true. You know, I want a big cake, and then I eat the whole cake, and then I'm as sick as a dog the next day. Or so many other ways in which my desires lead to suffering. So if I could just get free from all these desires, I wouldn't have to suffer. So what's Lord Buddha's solution? He says, well, why do you have these desires? Well, because of the ego, the sense of self. Now, if you could just get rid of that ego, you'd be rid of the desires, right? So that's the solution. Just get rid of your personal existence. And that does solve the problem, but now you no longer exist. So you've solved the problem at the expense of your own existence. In the material world, you know, I'm in debt up to my ears, my son's become a drug addict, my daughter's become a prostitute, I'm suffering from diseases, so finally I just take a gun to my head. I say, well, I've solved all the problems. I'll solve all my problems that way. It does, but it solved them by putting an end to my existence. And by the way, it doesn't work because you become a ghost instead of not existing. But even in the frame of thought, you know, if I put an end to myself, I won't have any problems. Well, that's a very severe solution to the problem. So the Vedic literature or the Vedic path says, let's not do it that way, by spiritual suicide, by killing the self off. First of all, it's very difficult to get free from the sense of self keeps persistently coming back. You know, I'm desiring not to desire. So the Vedic path is purify that desire. Vedic path says the ego is not the problem, it's the false ego. It's not the existence of myself, but it's the misidentification of myself with matter. I'm thinking I'm this body, I'm thinking I'm a Brahmin, I'm thinking I'm a Vaishya, I'm thinking I'm an American, I'm thinking I'm an Indian, I'm thinking I'm white, I'm black, I'm this, I'm that. And in relation to this body, I have so many desires. Then let me attain this. Let me achieve that. Let me have this. Let me enjoy that. When I know that I'm not this body, when I know that I'm a spiritual living being, when I know that I'm part and parcel of Krishna, then my desires become purified desires. Let me serve Krishna. That's also a desire. But that desire is not going to get me in hot water. That desire is going to bring me to the spiritual existence. So two very different paths. Is that okay? Okay. Yes, yes.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
I have a question that Buddhism believe in reincarnation and rebirth. And if what Buddha had taught, that if the ego ceases to exist, you don't have, if the ego, the self-consciousness, ceases to exist, you don't have any desires anymore. Mm-hmm. If you don't have any desires anymore, why do you have to take birth again?
Yeah, well, that's his answer, that if you get free from desires and the ego is essentially dissolved, then you've solved the reincarnation problem. You don't have to take birth again. Why don't you have to take birth again? Because you don't exist. Again, that solves the problem, but at the expense of, at what cost? At the cost of your very existence. You don't have to take birth again because you don't exist. There's an expression in English, throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, that's what Buddhism does. You know, it throws out the dirty bathwater, but whoops, the baby went with it. So you got free from suffering, but in the process, you lost yourself. So the Vedic teaching, and it's theoretical only because the self... Krishna says it can't be killed, it can't be, it's still there, but it's just sort of held in abeyance or checked or its existence is denied. It's not genuine realization in the sense that the self can't be killed. Nayam hanti nahanyate. We can't put an end to the self by any means. So the Vedic principle is then purify the self. If I'm suffering, you know, I'm in hospital, the problem is not to, you know, I can't eat and I can't enjoy because I've got jaundice, then the solution is not to kill myself but to cure the jaundice. Then I can eat, then I can do everything, but in the healthy condition. Is that okay? Yes.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, like other incarnation. Buddha as incarnation of Lord also propagated a philosophy or doctrine.
Slower.
Lord Buddha.
Yes.
As an incarnation of the Lord.
Attained.
As an incarnation of the Lord.
Yes.
Propagated a doctrine or a philosophy.
Yes.
But I had read somewhere in the Prabhupada purports that we need not follow even that doctrine, even if it is the philosophy propagated by the Lord, because he is a particular type of incarnation.
Yes. It's not that because Lord Buddha is the incarnation of Krishna, we should all go out there and become Buddhists. It's a tricky philosophy. What is it? Krishna says that he's everything. So he's the best cheater also. He's supreme in everything. So when it comes time to cheat the atheists, he's the best cheater. But the theists don't have to go for that. He's trying to bring them to Krishna consciousness indirectly through the back door. The devotees just go through the front door, let me surrender to Krishna. In the Govardhan Lila also, Krishna speaks like a materialist. He tells Nanda Maharaj, what are you worshipping Indra for? He has to pour the rain everywhere anyway. Everything just comes by karma. You don't have to, there's no... nothing else but that. Karma is the cause of everything. So he's speaking karma mimamsa philosophy, which is a kind of materialism. But it's not that Krishna is actually a materialist. He's having some fun and causing trouble to Indra just to pop his bubble. Is that okay?
I wanted to ask Maharaj, I read in the purports, Prabhupada purports, that we need not follow instructions or follow that particular philosophy of Lord Buddha, even if he is the incarnation of the Lord, because he is a particular type of incarnation.
Yes.
There's some term I had read. I just wanted to ask if...
maybe Vibhuti incarnation? Vibhuti means he has some particular opulence from the Lord. I'd have to look and see what it is. Okay. That would be my guess. But the idea is there that he's an incarnation as a cheater. So when he's, we don't have to take that, or just like there's another incarnation, Kalki Avatar. If you like, you can be liberated by Kalki Avatar. What do you have to do? Just be a Pukka demon so that he'll come and kill you. So that's also available, but we recommend instead that one take advantage of chanting Hare Krishna and get mercy directly from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Is that okay? Yes, somewhere in the back. Yes, we can't miss you. Okay. The microphone will make its way to you. It's a very clever microphone.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare
from
Krishna.
From a historical perspective, I have three questions.
One at a time, right? I have a short memory.
Okay. Early monasteries of Christian monasteries in Europe, say for example in 9th century, they were the offshoots of Buddhism. Would you like to comment on this?
Hare Krishna. In the 9th century, in the medieval monasteries in Europe, there was an offshoot of Buddhism. Would I like to comment on this? I'd love to, but I don't know anything about it.
And Buddha gave the idea of liberty, equality and fraternity. And same doctrines were preached by the revolutionaries in France in 1789.
So, true. Equality, egalite, fraternite, yes. So what's the question?
Because Do you find any similarities between those revolutionaries put forward in 1789 in France and Buddhists?
Well, there's some similarity, I suppose, that there we want equality and fraternity. But they're based on very different agendas. Lord Buddha's method was meditation, and the method of the French Revolution was the guillotine. The two very different tools for achieving social balance. One was to meditate, and the other was to cut off people's heads. One is ahimsa, and the other is just the opposite. So there's, I don't think the French revolutionaries risked being called Buddhists. But what we could look at there is that there's an underlying sense that keeps resurfacing throughout history, that we've got this imbalance, you know, that it's always these people are better than those people. We're better than you are. There's always the ups and the downs, the in crowd and the out crowd, the haves and the have nots. And there's this sense that there's something wrong with this. So right now, for example, you know, women are disadvantaged, so we want to bring women up. Or the Dalits are disadvantaged, so we want to bring them up. Or some group is disadvantaged, so we want to bring it all up and have equality. And it's very much a democracy. Democracy every means everybody has equal rights. So this idea keeps surfacing that there should be equal rights for at least all the human beings. The human beings should have an equal right to torment the animals and the birds and fish. That's a separate question. But at least in human society, there should be a level playing field. That's there in the Bhagavad Gita, Pandita Samadarshana. The learned person sees everyone equally, not only the human beings, but Brahmane Gavihashni, the cow, the elephant, the human being, all living beings. But it's on the spiritual platform, not on the material platform. When you try to make everyone materially equal, you get a total mess. You know, why should he be a surgeon? Why shouldn't he be a surgeon also? You know, he's just as much a human being as the surgeon is. Why shouldn't he be allowed to do surgery? Why should the professor be the professor? Why should the taxi driver not be the professor? Why should the person who's following all these so-called spiritual principles be the teacher? Why not the person who's drinking, smoking, and woman hunting? Why shouldn't he be a teacher too? Why are you cutting him out? You get this idea somehow, you know, why should this people, you want to have everybody equal, regardless of qualification, regardless of character, just because we value equality so much. So the guys who are down shoot the guys who are up and say, we want equality, so we're going to get rid of you. That's the Russian Revolution also. Shoot the Tsar and take over. So this is artificial. And what always happens, now that we've shot the Tsar, now we become the next Tsar. The French revolutionaries became the next edition of dictators and oppressors. And that's how history always goes. We kick you guys out because you're holding people down unfairly. Now we're going to take the post and hold everybody else down unfairly. That's history. So the Vedic principle is, no, don't try to get this material equality. It doesn't work. It's rubbish. We're not all materially equal. Some are stronger, some are more intelligent, some are more forceful, some are more this, some are more that, some are more artistic. Everybody's more of something and less of something else. So forget equality materially, but go for the spiritual equality. All living beings, the mother and the child, are spiritually equal. They're not materially equal. The elephant and the dog and the dog eater are spiritually equal. They're not materially equal. I'm not going to embrace the tiger because there's no difference between the tiger and my wife.
Do some monarchs like Ashoka or Kanishka, the Buddhism received royal patronage. Consequently, many became Buddhist monks and nuns on the royal resources, and they preferred living as a parasites.
Who is a parasite?
Those monks and nuns, instead of doing some purushartha, they preferred living as a parasite on the society. So, would you like to comment on this? As a result of royal patronage received?
There was royal patronage and then some people became parasites? The Buddhists became parasites, essentially? Uh-huh. Well, that can happen. You know, as soon as there's patronage, then somebody digs in and says, and wants to tap into the bloodline there. If money is coming in, let me grab it and live comfortably. But the principle is not wrong, that actually the royalty or the people who have power should patronize those who are spreading spiritual knowledge. It's their duty. It's beneficial. But those who are spreading spiritual knowledge should be voluntarily poor. That's how you keep balance. Those who have power should patronize those who are spreading spiritual knowledge, and those who are spreading spiritual knowledge should not live luxuriously at the expense of society. They should live practically like beggars. They should live very simply. They should live with the minimum. And then you get balance. Then the people who want luxury aren't going to crowd in and say, hey, we want to be Brahmins, we want to be Brahmins. I think we're happy as Vaishyas, thank you very much. Or we'll be Kshatriyas, we'll collect taxes, but we're not going to be Brahmins. So the Brahmins are on top, but in terms of opulence and all of that, power, they remain on the bottom to keep their purity. Is that okay?
Last question.
Oh, we went to four.
Yeah, yeah. this is only last. Because the lower caste people were looked down upon in the arena of society. Therefore, Dr. Ambedkar decided in 1935 that I will change the religion. And it attracted, Buddhist philosophy attracted him. So he and his followers took to Buddhism. So what would you say about it?
Who took to Buddhism? Dr. Ambedkar?
Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar.
Dr. Ambedkar took to Buddhism. Seems to me he took more to politics than to Buddhism. Apart from that, again, it's this idea that some people, why should some people be up and some people be down? But that equality should be established on the spiritual platform, not on the material platform. That's our Krishna consciousness movement, and that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu set the perfect standard of egalite, fraternite, liberté. everyone can take part in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's American woman. Otherwise, what's an American doing sitting here talking on Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam? Even the most disqualified people can take part by the grace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Should we stop there? Give me a sense. Who runs the show here? Who's in charge? Yeah? Shall we stop? Okay. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Shri Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Maharaj, for enlightening class. So we will have a 2-minute announcement. Please be seated. After that, we will have a kirtan. पहले बैठ जाइए सब लोग, हम लोग अनाउंसमेंट करेंगे और उसके बाद कीर्तन होगा. हरे कृष्णा. फर्स्ट ऑफ ऑल वी वुड लाइक टू वेलकम ऑल दोज गेस्ट हु हैव कम टू अवर टेंपल फॉर द वेरी फर्स्ट टाइम. सबसे पहले हम उन सभी भक्तों का स्वागत करना चाहेंगे जो आज पहली बार हमारे मंदिर में इस संडे फिश कार्यक्रम में आए हैं. अवर रिसेप्शन टीम ऑफ डिवोटीज विल वेलकम यू टू श्री श्री राधा गोपीनाथ टेम्पल बाय ऑफरिंग यू स्पेशल महाप्रसाद. And if you have any question regarding Krishna consciousness in general or this temple and its activities in particular,